WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
And welcome to WrestleSpective. I'm Jason Mann. Before we begin, I want to tell you about our sponsors. First, RotoReels.com, which is a great place to get downloads and DVDs of professional wrestling. And also InternationalObject.com, which is a wonderful podcast and blog with great essays, thoughtful, detailed essays about professional wrestling and the liberal arts. So check them both out, please. And my special guest today, returning to the program after a long absence, too long really, is Robert Newsom. He is the purveyor of the Atomic Elbow zine, excellent wrestling zine, only wrestling zine that I'm aware of, and it's good stuff. And also the professional wrestling Tumblr. You've got another Tumblr too, right?
I've got, I've got one where I just post like screen captures of whatever I happen to be watching at the time that ain't wrestling. It's a secondperiod.tumblr.com. I also have a podcast that I do that nobody knows about because I'm really bad at promoting it. But if you go to secondperiodindustries.blogspot.com, it's a 1 hour a week podcast that I do where I just play records and talk about them.
Awesome.
Yeah, my first job when I was 13 years old, I got a job at a small radio station in Glenville, Georgia. I was the 7 to 11 p.m. DJ four nights a week at the age of 13, playing Southern gospel music. So, yeah, my first job was a DJ at a tiny little FM station, and I would play records. I'd play gospel records for 4 hours unless there was a Braves game, and then I would just run the satellite feed and make sure the local commercials got played.
You're an interesting person, my friend.
I don't know about that, but I got to live with me, so of course I'm going to say it.
All right, so our match of choice today is the main event of WCW Beach Blast 1992. It is the WCW Tag Team Champions, the Steiner Brothers, taking on Terry Bam Bam Gordy and Dr. Death Steve Williams.
Yes.
Now, you made the choice of this match, and the reason being, at least one of the reasons being, is you are a big fan of Terry Gordy, and I guess have been watching him quite a lot lately. Is that correct?
I have been, for some reason, about 2 or 3 months ago, I was watching the promotional video that not just the video for the song, but there's a longer kind of home video release that I traded tapes with a guy, and he sent me a copy of this Freebirds, The Making of Bad Street USA. And there was some stuff on there, you know, the Freebirds. I mean, Gordy was a part of that, obviously. For some reason, my brain was like, look at Terry Gordy, man. They don't make them like him anymore. Even in the indies, really. I mean, there aren't a whole lot of wrestlers like Terry Gordy. His body type obviously is, you know, he's huge, but he's not defined. He's not chiseled. He's not cut. But he's not a big fat guy like, you know, he's not a one man gang or a Crusher Blackwell type. He's an anomaly, and he can move really well. And he's a really accomplished technical wrestler. I love his voice. Love listening to him talk. And I just really like Terry Gordy. Another reason I wanted to do this is because I do not like the Steiner Brothers.
Which is unusual because most people, at least early Steiner Brothers, are generally regarded as, you know, a pretty good team.
You know what? They're great. And I have no reason for not liking them. It's just that even as a kid, I couldn't get into it. I did not understand the appeal of these guys. And I've thought about it, and I think it's because I was influenced at a young age by the fact that neither of them are particularly accomplished talkers. And for me anyway, the kind of formative era of watching wrestling, it was all about what people said. It was all about what happened outside of the ring dictated what I paid attention to in the ring. So, of course, I was going to be paying attention to Ric Flair because he's Ric Flair. Arn Anderson, wonderful guy on the microphone. So, yeah, he was one of my favorites. The guys who could talk, Dusty Rhodes, you know, all of those guys, anybody that was with Jim Cornette by proxy became one of my favorites because Jim Cornette was amazing in the things that he did and the things that he said. So the Steiners never really had that. They were very accomplished as wrestlers, but they never had anybody with them who really kind of took that next step, you know, outside the ring.
Yeah. It's interesting now that I think about it, that the guys who were mostly the WCW good guys, you know, except for the times in which Flair was a good guy, most of them were not particularly good talkers. Sting wasn't much of a talker. The Road Warriors were good talkers, obviously, and Paul Ellering especially. You know, Luger wasn't a particularly good talker.
No.
You know, all those guys who were kind of on that side for the most part. Nikita wasn't much of a talker. I mean, Dusty obviously was, but I'm more thinking like post-88 WCW, and Dusty wasn't wrestling for most of that, so...
Well, they had a lot of managers, and obviously most of the managers that you think about were the bad guy managers. I mean, that's who you remember. But you know, there were so many auxiliary characters, mm-hmm. and I hesitate to use the word character because you know I've been really getting upset lately about the things that people know. I mean, obviously we all know how wrestling works. We all saw that Harley Race documentary that came on in the 90s. So there's no secrets anymore. But I went to a couple of Chikara shows this past weekend in Alabama and North Carolina. And I was struck by how much of an I know more than you contest was going on among the crowd, where people were talking about things like they were talking about angles and they were talking about botches and they were talking about work rates. And I was just standing there because I went to one of the shows by myself and I was standing there listening to this and thinking, you know, we shouldn't know this. And we do know this. And the box has been opened. There's no way to unknow it. But can we just pretend that we don't? And can we? And I know I'm violating my own proclamation by even writing about wrestling the way I do or talking to you about it the way we do, and I really enjoy that, but there just seems to be this desire to expose something that's already been exposed. And so I say all of that to say, yeah, we know how it works, and we know looking back we can apply that to the things that we saw, but you know, it ultimately is supposed to be fun. And I think that I know more than you contest tends to kind of suck some of the fun out of it.
Definitely.
Am I making sense with this, or am I just on a tear?
No. I do think that wrestling fans ruin things for everybody. So
wrestling fans, and I love them, and I love you if you're listening to this, but wrestling fans can be, not you, whoever you are listening to this, but wrestling fans can be the worst people in the world.
They can be, yes. I was being slightly facetious, you know, in my statement, but yes, but there are definitely, and I'm sure fans of everything, like, you know, sports or movies or whatever. I mean, you know, if you just get too wrapped up in something or you get too consumed with it, you can lose sight of it, I guess. You can lose sight of what makes it fun, and then you can be obnoxious and annoying, and sometimes you can be both. So it's tough. You know, it's you love something so much that that you almost start choking it to death because of how tightly you have your grip around it.
Man, you brought Steinbeck into this.
Good. We actually did that in a recent podcast, so that
good job.
Partly made me think of that, but yes.
And I would also like to say that I'm sitting at a table right now with handwritten notes about this match, the Oh, Lord. June 29th, 1992 issue of the Wrestling Observer that talks about this match.
Ooh.
And a printout of the Wikipedia page for Beach Blast 92. So I am as big a part of the problem, if not a bigger part of the problem, than the people that I was just complaining about. So I recognize the irony inherent in what is happening in this room right now.
Sure. So, Bill Watts came into WCW spring or so of 1992. Changes need to be made into WCW because it had last previous couple of years had fallen pretty flat. They'd lost Ric Flair. Their attempts to replace Ric Flair had not gone that well. Their attempts to... their attempts to become more colorful and become more cartoonish, become more WWF-like, those did not go well. They not that there were not some good things in 1991 WCW, certainly the Dangerous Lions story, that was fantastic. There was some good talent development. Sting had a little bit of room to breathe and did some good things. You had Vader come on. So I'm not... denying it. I'm not denying that there were certainly good things, but
I would also mention, and I know you know this, but I think it should be specifically mentioned, the return of Rick Steamboat or Ricky Steamboat to the WCW was, at least for me, a huge deal.
Yes.
Because he did some really great work. And this is not a plug, but I will say, the article in the second issue of my zine about the Clash of the Champions where Ricky Steamboat came back. I talk about how that features one of the greatest tag team matches I've ever seen when he and Dustin Rhodes took on Zbyszko and Anderson. And so he was doing some amazing work. In fact, the show that we're going to talk about, we're not going to talk about this match, but the best of seven Iron Man match with Rick Rude, it was not either of their best work, but it was really well-paced, solid, good wrestling match that told a compelling story and fit in well with what they were trying to do with this show.
Yeah, I haven't watched that one in a long time, but I loved that match for seeing it. I was first exposed to this 1992 WCW years later, through a little bit of tape trading. I got some of this stuff from this NWA tag tournament that was going on, which kind of led to this match. Let's get back to Bill Watts, and then we'll get into that. But Bill Watts came in. He was the promoter, owner of UWF Mid-South promotion, but had been out of the game for a few years because UWF closed down in 87, so about 5 years or so. So he's back. He's got that old school attitude, the hardliner stuff. Does some interesting things. Does some puzzling things during this time. Takes away the makes jumping off the top rope a disqualification, which I think the idea behind it always being that it didn't get as much of a reaction as it used to get, and that you could get heat by heels going off the top rope and doing moves and injuring guys. But it also making WCW seem like it was turning backward because of high-flying moves had become part of the normal style of wrestling and were exciting into fans. It didn't make much sense to do that. Also bringing back the NWA, which had not been a part of WCW for about a year or so, after Ric Flair had left and taken the NWA title with him. Took away mats on the outside, made the hardwood floors kind of the "we're tougher" kind of things. Also, changed the style, and this match really presents that a lot with emphasizing holds more mat work, and took a little bit of time to employ that over the next few weeks. And of course, a big thing of making changes in who they were pushing, and Bill Watts was in love with Terry Gordy and Steve Williams for sure.
And it's hard not to be. Those guys. And I would like to – nobody at least that I heard in this show, mentioned. And they did, and you know, maybe I'm jumping ahead. They did build them from Nagoya, Japan, which, you know, they were both doing a lot of work at the time with All Japan Pro Wrestling. But their team name in All Japan Pro Wrestling is one of the greatest tag team names I've ever heard, and it's the Miracle Violence Connection.
Yeah, I don't know why they wouldn't have not have used that. I don't get that either, because that's a great name. It'd be a fantastic name.
And I think there was a little bit of a little maybe lack of familiarity. I don't know the reaction that they got when they came out. But I did notice that, and maybe this was to get over the fact that these are bad guys. Williams and Gordy both came to the ring wearing kimonos or kimono-type robes to kind of accentuate their otherness. These guys, they look like they're probably from Alabama or Kentucky, or Oklahoma, but no, they're from Japan. See their robes? And so that's immediately bad guy.
Right.
We all know Japan is always bad guy.
Yes. Yeah, and Bill Watts wasn't afraid to use nationalism as well in the stories he presented. Not that wrestling's ever been shy about that. It was kind of a thing where I don't know if Gordy and Williams really became as big of a you got over with the fans as much as they were hoping they did, because they kind of moved away from them fairly quickly as far as being, you know, the strong dominant bad guy team. But they were setting this up as kind of a dream match, so to speak. They'd actually met at the Clash of the Champions right before this, which had been the first round of the NWA Tag Team Title Tournament. And actually, I believe they also, because their match was a second round match, so they had the entire first round and then one second round match at that Clash, and then Gordy and Williams beat the Steiners in that match. So this was kind of the Steiners getting a little bit of revenge. But the Steiners were also still WCW Tag Team Champions and had been that for quite a while. And they actually were also IWGP Tag Team Champions at the time.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Well, of course, it doesn't surprise me. Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, it doesn't surprise me.
Right.
Spoiler alert, guys, for something that happened in 1992. But eventually, the NWA tag team titles, they would actually win those in the tournament. I think the fight was it.
That was Great American Bash right after.
Yeah, was that like Barry Windham and Dusty Rhodes, right?
Dustin Rhodes.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, they would win that. I have a vague memory of that tournament because I watched this match. I'm probably going to seek that out and watch it next because
Basically, the entire rest of the tournament was at the Bash 92, which was like a couple weeks later, which is a weird, for that time, not much of a difference between pay-per-views.
Yeah, WCW was running almost an experimental kind of like three pay-per-views really quickly right after each other, because they had just done, I think, Wrestle War had just been done right before this one.
Yeah, that was May. So, yeah, in 3 months, which, you know, was crazy talk back in the day.
Yeah, one a month now is pretty standard, and there's only one organization doing it. I mean, obviously, you've got independents that are doing internet pay-per-views, but for, you know, cable pay-per-views, now they were only $20 at the time, but $20 in 92, I can't do the math. I don't know if that's equivalent to the $50 that you.
Yeah, probably not quite, but it's still obviously more than 20 now.
And almost nobody bought Wrestle War. I learned that from reading this issue of the Observer that I'm holding. But apparently, Wrestle War was a huge, well, not a huge failure, but it was a pretty low. It was a pretty low. What's that called? Buy rate. Yes, buy rate. God, see, again, this is the stuff that I shouldn't know, that we shouldn't be talking about, but here we are.
Which is sad, because that was the capping off of the Dangerous Alliance story, which is one of my favorite stories in WCW. So, well,
yeah.
Who cares if it drew money? It was awesome. So,
and through the magic of, you know, nerds who taped this stuff with de-scramblers back in the day, we can always, you know, gray area. Watch it on YouTube. So
right, exactly. So So yeah, so but I think the idea is that, you know, kind of Watts came in, changed a lot of stuff around. Some stuff was good, some stuff was bad. Some of the talent that he brought in was a few guys who were a little bit past their prime, but you know, he also was working with a mandate to cut expenses so that WCW would actually make money, which he apparently came extremely close to doing. Like, they lost like $600,000, which was nothing compared to what they were losing before that. So, and it was kind of going well. And then some comments that he made, or I guess there's some differing opinion on what exactly led him to be ousted of WCW. But those comments that he made probably weren't helpful.
Yeah, I don't know much about the what actually happened with Bill Watts. I mean, I know he was in there, and I know you couldn't jump off the top rope, and you couldn't have mats on the floor, but I really don't know a whole lot about, about the behind the scenes business. I was still paying attention to WCW in 92. I was watching it at the time, but that was right around the time — I'm going to date myself here, but that was right around the time I was finishing up high school and getting ready to go off to college, and I had discovered record stores. So there were other things competing for my attention from wrestling at that time. So sure. The Bill Watts era is – I mean, I know it was there, but I don't know. So what did he say? What did he do?
Well, he gave an interview to – I think it was Pro Wrestling Torch, in which Bill Watts is very strong – has very strong opinions, and he's very conservative, I guess libertarian in his viewpoints. And he made viewpoints basically saying that he believed that people should be able to run the restaurants that they want to their own way. It's a private business. If they want to be discriminatory, they should be able to do that. And then he kind of goes into a rant. And I've read these. It's been a long time since I've read these. I'm just kind of remembering this off the top of my head. But it's essentially a very racially charged rant, but it's him sort of not really expressing his true feelings, but expressing, like, essentially playing a character. Like, you ever watch The Office, or either version of The Office? Have you ever seen that show?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It'd be like Michael Scott or David Brent, like, making like some sort of like ill-advised like impersonation or some sort of like racial caricature or whatever. So he was basically playing the restaurant owner, and he goes in this big rant that is like, you know, uses a lot of racial slurs and is like very, offensive. But if you took it literally, and I don't think you were supposed to. But anyway, so I guess that, and he did that, I think, even like right when he got this job, or before, probably before he got the job, because I've heard interviews that he's given saying that I had done that before I got the job. They knew about it when I got hired. It wasn't a big deal. And so, and I guess it was used against him in early 93 when they decided that it was time to go. I think one story I've heard is that Hank Aaron, who was a TBS executive at the time, got wind of it. And that was one thing that created a problem. So there's a lot of, like, you know, people hear things, and I don't know if exactly the entire story of that is clear. So I don't really want to pass around, you know, secondhand things, but not that I can hear firsthand information. So.
Hearing you say all of that reminds me a little bit that I actually did know something about this, but I guess had forgotten, because it sounds very familiar to hear you talk about it. And I think because it was – I mean, obviously, being from Georgia, you know, this disgusting stuff in our history is kind of nailed into the head from an early age. But I think these comments were – if I'm not mistaken, in reference to Lester Maddox, who retired from politics and
that's right,
and opened a chicken restaurant, and Maddox, of course, was you may not know, but a notorious racist and segregationist, and in fact used to carry an axe handle around and had little little axe handle lapel pins made up because that's the classy kind of thing that happened in Georgia back then and really still happens today to a different extent. It's been updated for the 21st century, but there's still creeps down here. There's a country song, the artist escapes me, there's a country music song called Eatin' Chicken and Dodgin' Axe Handles, which was written about Lester Maddox and his chicken restaurant. Hmm. But now I've really thrown this off track. But
that's all right. It is also worth noting that that Bill Watts also was one of very few promoters who was willing to push African-American wrestlers.
But wasn't there a racial discrimination lawsuit in WCW at this time?
No, that was more – that was later. That was in the late 90s.
Okay. I didn't know when that happened, but
– yeah. I think the company had a spotty track record, in different ways of
– well, they didn't have their first black champion until 92.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, they really only existed for 3 years before 92, so.
Right. I mean, but, you know, if you look at the WCW is a continuation of the NWA, I guess, was
– right. I get what you mean, certainly. Yeah, the professional wrestling industry has a horrible track record of racism. I mean, that's obvious.
Why do we like this again?
I don't know, because there's good even with the bad, I guess. So it's fascinating, if nothing else. So, but my point is not to bury Bill Watts here, but to just understand the context of what happened. And yes, we've gone a little bit off track, but that's okay. So the match itself. Jim Ross and Jesse Ventura are here together calling the match. JR predicts that Gordy and Williams will win in what is called an upset. Jesse says that that's a bold statement given that, of course, the Steiners are tag champions. So we are very tentative when we start. Ross, which I never really thought about, mentions that Scott Steiner normally starts with the Steiners, which I think maybe I've heard has been mentioned in commentary before, but just not something that I thought about, but a nice detail, of course. He and Gordy lock up for a bit, kind of push each other around. They're tentative. They're circling around. Steiner eventually gets a hard shoulder block and then Gordy slaps him in the face. Then we have Scott taking him down, and punching him to the ground. Eventually Randy Anderson steps in, and then we get like a nice moment where both teams kind of jump in the ring and Randy Anderson has to calm things down a little bit because, you know, things are getting a little too fired up. You know, we can't have any of these shenanigans in our professional wrestling match.
Well, the match starts off and when that slap happened, when Terry Gordy slaps Scott Steiner in the face, that was harsh.
Yeah.
I mean, you felt that. And the match was very, for lack of a better term, it was very Japanese style. I don't know if the crowd really knew what to make of it. They're all, you know, kind of quiet, a little subdued, kind of like the Japanese crowds. I mean, obviously the cultures that these take place in are different, but the influence of, I mean, obviously Williams and Gordy had come freshly to this event from Japan, but the Steiners obviously had some time in Japan as well, and the style here was really I guess strong style, for lack of a better term, but
yeah,
a lot of technical mat wrestling.
Right. Yeah, I feel like it's more, I mean, they certainly work in a lot, you know, some big suplexes and lariats and some big hard hitting but especially the early part makes me think of like a 50s match, you know.
I believe they're called Steiner lines.
Yes.
There's a story where it's possibly apocryphal. I just remember hearing a story about a fan who had met one of the Steiners at a convention or somewhere and mentioned either a clothesline or a Hurricane Rana or something, and was roundly chastised by him for not calling it either a Frankensteiner or a Steiner line, because obviously when Scott or Rick does it, it has a different name. But
right. Yeah, yeah. I do remember, well, I, Scott, when he was Big Papa Pump, even worked it into his gimmick where he was mad that the commentators were using the word Hurricane Ron instead of Frankensteiner. So that maybe that's he feels good. That way in general as well.
Big Papa Pump.
Yeah.
I was wondering how long it would be before he brought that up.
Yeah. It took actually half an hour, so.
Garbage.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. So but the Steiners keep up with it really well, and like I said, there's a lot of wrestling, a lot of waist locks and reversals and go behinds and down on the mat and just the match itself moves quickly, but it's all on the mat, and I think Jim Ross does a really good job keeping things fresh and keeping them moving and keeping them interesting. Ventura kind of takes a step back on this one. But the work of Jim Ross on this match really kind of brings home a little more of the excitement, I think, than maybe the people in the in Mobile, Alabama got out of this.
Yeah. I feel like they were engaged with the match for the first half of the crowd, and then they sort of lose it a little bit, but they do pop for some of the hard-hitting things near the end, especially some of the big harsh moves. So yeah, you're right. It is, but I do feel like they were with it for a while and they kind of lose it a little bit, midway to late in the match. Doc tags in, Ross goes into his collegiate background as Ross was known for doing.
Oh, he loves college.
He does love college wrestling and football. Of course, Williams being one of the big stars of Mid-South UWF toward the end, and Ross being the announcer then, and then they were also tied together when Dr. Death had his run in WWF. So
The Varsity Club, which
how Ross even brings up Ross when Dr. Death and Rick are in the match together. Ross even brings up, hey, they were in the Varsity Club together. I'm like, wow, that was 4 years before.
How weird is it that the devil worshiper guy was in the Varsity Club?
That is sort of unexplainable.
Because think about high school or college. You know, the kids who are on the 13th step of the 13th pyramid, chewing on the betel nut with a Buddha Dean, they're not going out for football.
No.
They're not dressing out for gym.
Well,
even.
Maybe so, the idea is that Kevin Sullivan was trying to corrupt the jocks.
Oh man, it was an invasion angle.
Yeah.
Oh.
That actually would be kind of a cool idea. You could, I always sort of enjoy like the straight-laced character slowly evolving into more evil or more sinister or some sort of like, changing into, darker characters. I always find that story to be kind of naturally interesting, and I feel like wrestling, WWE in particular, but I'm not as familiar with a lot of other organizations, but I feel like I haven't seen that done in a substantial way.
Do you watch Chikara much at all?
Not a whole lot.
They're doing exactly that, well, not exactly that, but they're doing that with Tim Donst, where he lost a mask versus hair match, and since his head was shaved, he's become this just horrible, and he was already a bad guy, but he was kind of a likable bad guy, a jolly sort of bad guy, and he's just become this horrible person, and it's done so well, and it's such a slow burn, and you can kind of see where they're going with it, but it's a joy to watch. Tim Donst, I didn't really – I'm not going to say I disliked him because I didn't really pay that much attention to him. But once this angle started with him losing his hair and then losing his mind, it's brilliantly done. And obviously, if you've read anything I've written, I will praise Chikara basically anything they do. But this is a standout even among the other stories that they're telling right now. So it's happening over there. You should check it out if you can.
I actually watched King of Trios and did a podcast that has not yet aired, but it was recorded before I'm doing this, obviously. And so I saw the Donst attacking Eddie Kingston thing, but I didn't quite understand everything that was going on because I didn't know the story ahead of time. So good to know.
Yeah, it's being very well done. And he it's continued the two shows. I can't wait for people to see the stuff that happened at the shows in Alabama and North Carolina that I was at, because it's continued there, and there's some good stuff coming from him, I think.
Cool. So Doc gets a single leg takedown and Scott rolls through. Then they do some more switching and they get in the ropes. Then we get a 5-minute time call when we're barely 3 minutes into the match. Now, I need to say something about this, because I get that they booked a half hour draw and they didn't have a half hour to do it. Like, I understand that the story of this match is that they're trying, is that, you know, the end of this match has to be at least some sort of match and some sort of resolution in which neither team wins.
Here's something that, okay, did you or did not watch this whole event?
I did not watch the whole event.
In the match earlier in the evening, it was Terry Taylor. I got to pull up the printout here. It was Terry Taylor and Ron Simmons. It was a short match. The whole match went 5 or 6 minutes. They called 5 minutes at around the 3 o'clock match or mark of the match too. I was watching it on YouTube and I had a counter right there, so I could tell. Yeah. And what's interesting is that was not – I even made a note about this. That was not a time-limited match. So why would they have called 5 minutes in the match unless they were trying to create – that? This is conspiracy theory. Unless they were trying to create the perception among the people in the arena in Mobile, Alabama, that 3 minutes was really 5 minutes. Were they actually trying to get people to believe somehow by calling times in matches that were not time limited? Were they trying to give a different perspective on the passing of time to these people? And obviously these people had watches. They could have timed it themselves. But sure. It's just interesting to me that in previous matches they were calling out time increments that were not accurate and were not necessary.
Yet the Rude Steamboat match goes legitimately 30 minutes, I believe.
You know what?
Iron Man match.
I was so interested in the match itself that I didn't look. The Simmons Taylor Terry Taylor match was terrible. At least I thought it was. So I was doing things like checking Twitter and looking at the timer. Sure. But the Rude Steamboat match, I didn't even think to do that.
Yeah.
So
This is obviously a great show. I mean, besides the Rude Steamboat match, you have the Sting Texas Jack match. I forgot this was on that show as well. So,
yeah, that match was great.
I don't know how good the Dangerous Alliance match is, but I imagine with the guys who are in there, that has to be pretty good.
Trying to see what all was on this. I don't remember that.
Okay.
I do remember that. That was Ole Anderson was the referee, and he disqualified Arn Anderson because Arn Anderson came off the top rope, and they were really trying. There were two disqualifications. I think the other was a disqualification in this same show. Yeah, one of the falls in the Steamboat Rude match was a top rope move disqualification.
Right.
They were really trying to hammer into the audience that you don't come off the top rope. This is bad.
And part of the re-education of it was because that was during the Rude Steamboat match where Rude jumps off the top rope, gets the DQ, but then gets a pin to sort of even up a little bit. Or, you know, he loses one, but he gains one, and his opponents have been more punished because, you know, he came off the top rope and did that disqualification worthy move.
Yeah, so they're really trying to hammer home the top rope, the illegality of the top rope.
Yeah, so. But I don't know. If you run out of time, I feel like you do double DQ or – like I was thinking like on TV, they'll do TV time remaining. You could do pay-per-view time remaining, but then you're kind of – oh, you're telling everybody it's going to be a draw, so maybe that doesn't work. But I don't know. I just feel like I get like shaving 30 seconds off or something, but 2 minutes, you know, off of a 5 minute time call, that just doesn't do much for me.
Well, they had to leave a pretty big window for the bikini contest.
Well, Missy Hyatt and Medusa, you know.
Yeah. That was horrible.
Yeah. So back to the match.
Oh yeah, we were talking about a match.
We were. Doc gets some hard knee lifts in the corner after a break, then runs into a boot. Scott tries a German suplex, but Doc elbows out of it. Then Doc charges, but Scott is able to get a sunset flip for two. Scott then gets a headlock takeover, which allows JR to bring up Jack Briscoe as a man who employed that maneuver as well. So a lot of old references here by Ross. He works a side headlock for a little while. Rick finally comes in, and we get some barking from the crowd because he is, of course, the dog-faced gremlin.
The crowd loved him.
Yeah.
They loved Rick Steiner.
Yes, they did. And then Doc pauses, consults with his partner, and then they continue the match, which I thought was a nice little moment. It's like, you know, just a little chat, just, you know, like get some strategy going. It's a good times.
Just checking in.
Yeah.
Making sure that the strategy didn't change now that now the other Steiner is in there.
Exactly. So Rick's in with the belly-to-belly, and then Doc bails outside. He's joined by Gordy, who gives some nice encouragement to his partner. We're back in, and Doc gets some forearms and a big body slam. He gets the three-point stance, and he knocks down Rick a few times, sort of like cutting off his knee. How do you feel about that move?
You know, I liked it. I don't know anything about college football. Well, that's not true. I work on a college campus across the street from the 15th largest stadium on the planet. So I've absorbed a little about college football from that. But, you know, the football move, I like it. It's a tough one to – and here we go with the forbidden knowledge again. It's a tough one to sell because – you've got to put yourself in a position where you can't logically see a dude getting down in a three-point stance. Maybe your back is turned until you turn around, and then there's this burst of speed. So it has to be done properly, I guess. And I'm no wrestler. I've never, you know, I don't claim to be. So I don't know how the mechanics of the body works to get this out there, but it has to be done right. But I liked it, and I like the chaining them together in this. You know, while he was getting up, he would get down into another three-point stance and hit him with it just as he kind of stands up. And so that was good.
I feel like you just like the amount of contact being made on that doesn't seem like it would be enough to create the flip that the other, you know, just hitting the guy in the knee like he is would be enough to make him go in motion as much as Rick is.
Well, Steiner's kind of rolling. Oh, it's like when you see a stuntman get hit by a car. They kind of roll and transfer that momentum laterally onto like the hood of the car.
Right.
And so that's kind of what's happening here. And it looks like a lot of fun. and now I'm not going to sit here and say that I would gladly take a hit for fun from Gordy or Williams, because I wouldn't.
Sure. Or the Steiners, for that matter.
Or either of those guys, especially Big Papa Pump.
Yeah.
And his chainmail headdress. But it looked like a lot of fun to just kind of roll over a guy's back and flip that way. It reminds me of trampoline wrestling.
Yeah.
But I don't know anything about wrestling or football, so.
Okay.
I do know that later in the match, Ventura, when he's talking about Steve Williams, says that Williams has seen all kinds of suplexes in his 4 years at Oklahoma, which I wrote this question down to ask you or the listeners, even though they can't respond. Can you suplex in football?
Williams also wrestled for the 4 years and played football. He did both.
Okay. All right. So that's what he was talking about then. All right.
Yes. So yes, so he does the two of the shoulder tackles, and the third one, Rick hits him with a really hard clothesline and gets two, which draws a big pop from the crowd. Gordy tags in. Rick sort of gets stuck in the corner on the bad guy side. Gordy misses an elbow in the corner. Rick tries to get a German suplex, but sort of gets distracted by Randy Anderson, and that momentary lapse allows Gordy to hit his own side suplex. The time call comes at 10 minutes, so now at least 5 minutes have happened between the time call. So I just, again, I guess they just, well, no, I, that's not quite true because it's 7 minutes in, so they shaved another minute off of it. I think from here on out, they're basically accurate, though. So, Rick manages a German suplex. Gordy's able to tag in Doc. Rick gets a couple of forearms, but then Doc sends Rick out onto the ramp with a sends him out on the ramp, and then he follows with a really hard shoulder block through the ropes, which sends Rick even further back. That was really cool.
How do you feel about the ramp?
I like the ramp as a novelty, but I get why they don't have it now.
Yeah, it just makes the outside of the ring stuff a little more difficult, especially if there's a manager involved, because you really – and this is not my idea. I've absorbed this from somewhere, and I can't remember the exact source of it, but I heard somebody say this, and I agree completely. You want to be able to chase a guy around the ring.
Yeah.
And when there's a ramp there, but it also allows for – you know, more possibility of moves on the ramp, especially when you watch the Sting and Cactus Jack match. I mean, there was a lot. It was a false count anywhere. Actually, it was a false count anywhere on the Gulf Coast match. So they could have gone, you know, over to Texas if they wanted to. But there's a lot of stuff on the ramp there that was well done. But
yeah, maybe you and I have had that conversation, or I've had that conversation with someone on the podcast where talking about some of that stuff. But I agree. I think the
and that may be where I got it from.
Yeah, I think the ramp itself has there's some nice advantages to being able to get the action onto there, but you do lose being able to go around the ring, and you do lose some of that space down there, which I think is valuable as well. So, and stuff. But they use it nicely in this match, you know. And eventually, I lost my place.
Oh, we're at the shoulder block through the ropes.
Yes, yes. Sorry. And then Rick hits a sunset flip while Doc is holding the ropes. Scott nails Doc with a forearm to get him down, and then the sunset flip gets two. Jesse's surprised that the ref made the count there, which is kind of a nice moment for Jesse. And I think it's another example of like trying to establish, okay, we're doing things a little bit differently now, where that sort of thing probably wouldn't have been noted before. But now that they're more strictly enforcing the rules, or at least kind of like the ideas of the rules, he makes that comment there.
And it is worth noting that the Steiner brothers, the good guys that were loved by the crowd, were the first team to cheat.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
Gordy and Williams tried to play it straight, but they had no choice.
Yeah.
They were driven to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Horrible Steiner brothers.
Yeah. Well, the Steiner brothers would show the true colors many years later.
That's true.
Yeah.
Oh boy, we all know what happened.
1999, man. Both Steiners were bad guys, so I remember it well. Gordy locks in a half crab in the middle of the ring for quite a while,
which looked painful.
Yes. And then Rick is able to sort of take him over and grab the leg and get a near fall off that, which is pretty cool. Eventually, Doc from the outside kicks Rick from the rope there. Gordy gets a spinning toehold, works that for a bit. Jesse brings up Dory Funk Jr. as the master of the spinning toehold. So Jesse bringing in the old school references as well. Rick eventually fights it off, hits a belly to belly. Scott comes in, gets some kicks and a waistlock takedown. Then he wrenches Gordy's legs, but then Gordy's able to grab them too, and they sort of do like they fight off of that. Scott's eventually able to cradle Gordy and rolls through for the pin attempt. He's sort of like in the perfect plex position once he rolls over. Fisherman suplex position. But then Gordy gets the tag, and Doc nails him with some hard boots. Scott then tries a suplex after being able to avoid being slammed in the turnbuckle, but Doc blocks it. Gordy nails him with a blow from behind. Scott attacks Gordy, and the ref prevents Rick from running in, so Doc nails him from behind. So a little bit of shenanigans now from the Miracle Violence connection. Not played straight now.
It was a good way. You know, no, well, I mean, they were driven to it. So, they were driven to it.
There you go.
They're clearly the victims here.
Sure.
But there was really good tension being built here. Especially, you know, it kind of started at that point where the ref was distracted, and it kind of mounted from there. They did a really good job of it. There's a woman in the front row wearing a red shirt with black hair who checks her watch. Somewhere around this time. It was very obvious. I tend to watch the people in the crowd a lot, and the watch checking was pretty obvious. Before all of this happens, though, Jim Ross says something that I think is worth exploring, and he says, and I wrote this down verbatim, Dr. Death, who got that nickname in the ninth grade in Lakewood, Colorado Junior High, and then he gets cut off by action in the ring. Now, what are you doing at the age of 15 that gets you the nickname Dr. Death? Because people were calling me names in the ninth grade, but they weren't that cool.
No.
So how does this work? What did he do in the ninth grade that got him the nickname Dr. Death?
He was very big and strong and angry, I guess, you know.
And a murderer. Look, Steve Williams is not a murderer. I'm sure he's a nice guy. Please don't come after me. But
he's not alive anymore, so.
Well, I'm saying ghost.
Right.
Steve, or his family or his friends.
Sure.
Look, I don't want to make any – anybody called Dr. Death in life has powerful connections even after. So
I would imagine.
I just want to know what happened in the ninth grade in Lakewood, Colorado.
It would be nice.
Jim Ross knows, but he got cut off.
Yeah. Maybe we can ask him on Twitter.
Yeah. He never came back to it.
Yeah. So I'm trying to now imagine the ways in which he would get that nickname, and I'm having a very difficult time imagining it. So
none of the reasons I can think of are good.
No,
it all involves tragedy on some level.
Yeah. Moving a little bit ahead. We have Gordy gets after Scott gets caught in the heel corner and Doc attacks his knee, Bam Bam gets a step over toe hold. It's not really the STF because he's not grabbing the cross face, but I don't know what else to call it because
it was, I actually wrote down in all capital letters, what is this move?
Uh-huh.
Because I have no idea what that was.
The step over toe hold is like, what's the F stand for in step over toe hold? I feel like I should know that, but
is it face lock?
Okay, there you go. That makes sense. So it's just the step over toe hold without the face lock, basically.
Yeah, but it didn't look like a Terry Funk or a Dory Funk
step over
toe hold. It was done weirdly.
Well, it was the STF without the F, basically. I mean, it was
just an ST.
Yeah, it was an ST, exactly. So he wrenches the leg pretty good. Jesse and JR make a nice job of making a big deal about it to make it seem painful. Then Gordy gets a big clothesline for two. I find it interesting here that Ross keeps referring to Scott as the kid.
Times. Rick is called the big brother a lot.
Right. But I don't remember the Steiners even in their younger matches ever being referred to that by Rick or by Ross. Maybe he did, but I don't remember, you know, him saying this kid, you know, has got a bright future. I mean, he'll say that about like some of the young WWE guys once in a while, but it's just sort of, it seems odd that he brought it up here. I mean, maybe it was something he did more commonly than I realized, but it just stood out to me. So Doc is in. He stands and he turns the knee. Then he locks a half crab. It doesn't really bend down too far. But then Gordy in and he holds Scott and then locks in a deeper half crab. Scott tries to drag himself toward his corner, but Gordy pulls him back. Then Scott, he grabs, or Doc grabs Scott's legs, sort of in the Boston crab position. He actually pins Scott's shoulders back, gets two, and then is able to turn it over. And it's more of a lion tamer than a Boston crab. He's kind of upper, and he's kind of got the neck turned.
Yeah, he's really – there's not much of his body on the mat.
Right.
It's just kind of chest and head. Everything below, like the pectoral muscles, is wrenched up, and it looked pretty – I don't know. It looked pretty serious.
Yeah. And I love how Jesse mentions the strategy of Doc going for that pin attempt and forcing Scott to raise his shoulder, which made him easier to get over.
That was
great detail.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, I remember that now that you said it, but you're right. That was definitely done well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Scott tries to power out and get himself over to Rick, but Doc stops it. Then Scott's able, but that only lasts for a bit, as Scott is able to inch himself closer and finally get the tag. Rick hammers Doc, gets a power slam for two, gets a second rope bulldog, and Rick clears Gordy out of the ring. The Steiners set up their finisher, which is basically a top rope bulldog with the guy on Rick's shoulders. Gordy breaks it up. He sends Scott out. Then Doc nails Rick with a lariat. Gordy goes to the top rope for a power slam. Goes to second rope because I was
second rope, yeah. Right?
There's no tag, so but there's no tag, so the ref does not call the pin. Gordy sent back out. Doc gets on top of Rick, but then Rick kicks out. And there's another two. He goes for the two again, another two. So the crowd kind of thought that was it because, you know, second row power slam was a pretty big deal in 1992. Then Gordy comes back in, hits a drop kick, gets another two. There's a pretty long segment of the bad guys cutting off the ring. We get the time call of 5 minutes left in the match. Doc does a side backbreaker, but does it like twice where he lifts the guy up, hits him, and then grabs him and lifts him again. And Gordy comes in, does some forearms and a boot, gets a suplex for two, and we're at 4 minutes left. Rick does get a few punches, but you can tell that he's fatigued and there's not a whole lot behind them. Then Doc boots him down really hard. In these last 5 minutes, there's quite a few really hard-hitting things going on here.
Yeah, I mentioned before the kind of the way they build tension in this match, but the last 5 minutes, actually really the last 3 minutes of this match, are really well paced, really exciting. You know, both the people watching on the internet 20 years later and the people there. I mean, the crowd finally woke up. The woman who was checking her watch actually stands up and is kind of waving her hands in the air. But it's a good match. It's well paced, and you're right. These last few minutes really bringing everything together that's kind of gone on before.
And then Doc locks in a headlock, but it's really, you can tell that it's a tighter than usual type headlock. It's almost like a chin lock, but it's, you know, the arms wrench in there pretty good. And there's 3 minutes left. The ref checks the arm, but Rick's okay. He elbows out, but runs right into a knee. Then Doc hits a gut wrench power bomb, but only gets two. At this point, Jesse brings up that he thinks Gordy and Williams are way ahead on points and that the Steiners are lucky that this is a professional wrestling match, not an amateur wrestling match. Just kind of an odd thing to say with 2 minutes left, but I guess that was a point they felt like they had to get in. So,
yeah, I think they were also trying to – it's almost like they knew that Gordy and Williams were going to somehow win some belts soon, and they were trying to – tell the people watching at home that these guys were worthy of winning them.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they couldn't have known that because the tournament hadn't even happened yet. But
exactly. Right. But yes. So Doc, he picks Rick up. He rams him in the turnbuckle once, but the second one fails. Rick gets a really, really hard clothesline. Then Gordy's able, but
Steiner
line. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Yes. But Doc's right in his corners. He's able to tag in Gordy. Then there's a Steiner line into the corner. I'm sorry. It's a clothesline by Gordy, or perhaps a lariat into the corner. And then Rick hits another really hard Steiner line on Gordy. And this is actually the harder one. This gets a big awe from the crowd of amazement of how harsh that was. Rick is able to crawl into the corner and gets the tag. Scott hits a back body drop on both, body slams on both, clotheslines on both. Then a butterfly powerbomb, which takes several seconds to play to the crowd when he does this before he lands it. And then as the countdown is happening from 10, he takes too long to set up the Frankensteiner. He hits it, but right as he hits it, the count goes to zero and it's time limit draw.
Yeah, the bell rings before the three count can get in there, because goodness knows nobody was getting up from that Frankensteiner.
No, it is a it's a good move, you know.
Was this, now that we're at the end, there's two observations overall that I had, and number one was this a main event match?
Yeah, I think that was sort of a question at the time of sort of like, this was sort of an odd choice. I mean, I think because of how heavily they were pushing both the tag tournament and Gordy and Williams, that you could say, okay, this was kind of the most important thing on the show. Sting was the champion, but he was facing Cactus Jack. I believe it was a non-title match, and Cactus was a rung below him at that point.
You know. Well, it's interesting because after I asked that question by writing it in my notes, I found on their online archive the copy of the Observer that I was talking about, and the article in the Observer kind of asked the same question: is, was this really a main event match? But they also say that there was nowhere else on the show to put it, because, and here's the part about wrestling that I don't like. You know, but we know this. They knew this was going to be a time limit draw. They knew that the Sting and Cactus Jack match had to happen at a certain point in the event to allow Cactus Jack to attack Steamboat after his match and get the best of him, using the excuse that Steamboat was tired from having wrestled the Iron Man match against Rude. So they kind of backed themselves into a corner in terms of sequencing by doing that, because this was really the only place on the card that this match could be. And I thought that was a very interesting observation from the Observer. Ha ha. But there really wasn't anywhere else to put this match, even though it suffered from coming after these matches, that in terms of the stories being told and in terms of the action that you saw in and out of the ring were probably a little more exciting.
Yeah. That's a good observation from the Observer.
And another question I have is that, and this, there was nothing in there about it, but I didn't know if Terry Gordy was maybe coming off of an injury, or there wasn't a lot of Terry Gordy in this match.
That's a good point. I don't know that off the top of my head, but he left. Well, he left WCW right before Halloween Havoc. He was actually supposed to be on Havoc, and then he was fired or quit right before then. So he didn't last too long, but I don't know about beforehand whether he was hurt or not. I feel like he was a big part of the other matches, so maybe they just wanted to focus on Williams for whatever reason, or maybe he was just hurt, but I don't think he was, you know, out for a significant amount of time or anything like that.
I mean, he was obviously able to do quite a bit, because we saw that happen, but it just seems like, and again, this is probably my personal bias and nothing, you know, no slight against Williams, but if you got Terry Gordy, you use Terry Gordy, you know. But there wasn't a whole lot of him. I mean, he was in the ring for a significant amount, but for a match that at least on paper lasted half an hour, you didn't get 15 minutes of Terry Gordy, it seems.
Yeah, you probably 2/3 of it was Doc. So, I didn't even think about that before you mentioned it, but yeah, that's absolutely true. So Williams and Gordy would win the WCW tag titles at the Omni, July 5th, 92, just a few weeks after this. Then they would win the NWA tag title tournament a week later. So they would become the WCW and the NWA tag team champion simultaneously. Now, this NWA tag team title was actually a brand new title, that because the NWA never had an official tag team title. The ones that Mid-Atlantic had were called the NWA Tag Team Championship, but they were just Mid-Atlantic's version of that. They might as well have been the Mid-Atlantic Tag Team Championship. And then that eventually evolved. They started calling it the NWA Tag Team Titles, and they started calling it the WCW Tag Team Titles when the name change happened. But there was never one official sanctioned NWA Tag Team title before this. There were just many local versions of the NWA tag team titles. So it was just sort of weird to, because, you know, this whole NWA thing was kind of bringing back tradition, and they would bring back the NWA title a few months later too, and really start bringing it into the storylines in early 93. But it was just sort of odd to, like, oh, we want tradition. Oh, we want the NWA name. We're going to just invent a new title to do it.
Yeah. I'm making those kind of sweeping changes. It hardly seemed respectful of the tradition, especially when you consider how much longer the NWA was a thing, you know, after this happened. I mean, it wasn't too much longer before you had Shane Douglas, you know,
right,
controversially throwing it on the ground, and mm-hmm. you know, the whole ECW thing. And so I seem to remember, and maybe this was Mid-Atlantic that became this, but there was also I don't think it was an NWAY, but there was a six-man NWA tag team championship.
Yeah, that was I believe that was Mid-Atlantic as well, and that was sort of like end of the 80s, because the six-man titles were sort of popular from because of the Freebirds, but mostly I think from the Freebirds Von Erichs feud. They had them in World Class.
Yeah.
I think NWA just sort of copied that, or Crockett, Mid-Atlantic, copied it. So,
if you're and you know, you're listening to a podcast, so you probably are. If you're anywhere near the internet, do a Google image search for that, because those belts, I think the NWA six-man tag team championship belt and the NWA television championship belt, the one that that Tully Blanchard had for a while.
Yeah.
Those are my two favorite belt designs that I've ever seen. Because I don't know, why should you look at my favorite stuff? But still, go do it. They look great.
Yeah, that's a nice looking belt. I think I like the television one a little better, but this is a strong one. It looks a decent amount like the tag belt, I feel like, but
yeah, it's pretty close. But I think and I'm not actually looking at the picture of it online right now, but I'm trying to remember it in my brain, which is a mistake. It seems like the front plate was a little different on the six man, but who knows?
Yeah. So Gordy and Williams would last, like I said, up until they would lose the titles a couple months later to Barry Windham and Dustin Rhodes, who they beat in the NWA Tag Team Title Tournament. And then Gordy would leave. It would be Windham and Rhodes against Steve Austin and Steve Williams. Steve Austin's real name, of course, being Steve Williams, at Halloween Havoc. And then I think Williams was pretty much gone after that. The Steiners, they left WCW in fall of 92. There was actually a story they began with Scott and Ricky Steamboat. It began with Scott teaming with with Marcus Bagwell. I think Rick was hurt or what have you. And then Bagwell screwing up during the match and Scott attacking him. And then the next week they had Scott and Ricky Steamboat in a match, and Scott takes advantage of Steamboat sort of hurting himself during the match and wins the television title. And they're obviously heading toward a heel turn, but Scott gets hurt and then leaves WCW, and then the Steiners debut in WWF in early 93. So,
was there a reason given, within the stories being told for why they left, or was it just those guys are gone?
I think they just left. I don't think there was ever a, it was just, I think they had been off TV for a few months and then they were gone, and I think their WCW moved on.
And Flair was back by that point too, right?
Well,
or close to it.
It was close to it, yeah. Flair came back on TV, I think, Super Brawl 3, which is February 93, and then he...
Because that took a lot of wind out of everything else's sails. They did that. I remember the documentary on TBS, like the kind of a 30-minute video interview and retrospective of Flair that they kind of produced as, I don't know if it was to thank him for coming back or to entice him to come back, but I seem to remember that that happening somehow, unless I just made it up, but I don't think I did.
Yeah. I wasn't watching that. I don't think I've seen that, but Watts was gone the same day that Flair came back, but Watts was instrumental in bringing Flair back. They were negotiating for a while and so forth. So, but Super Bowl III is the show where those things happen. So, well, obviously Bill Watts wasn't fired on camera or anything, but he was gone that day, I believe. So, yeah, it's interesting. They were a big part of this, and then both 6 months later, they're both gone, and the promotion, a few months later, is completely, changed over with another regime. So,
what did the Steiners? And this is where my ignorance kind of comes into play. What did they do in WWF? Who are they working with there?
Not a whole lot, really. They had a feud with the Head Shrinkers, Samoan SWAT team in WCW. So they'd wrestled them before in WCW. I know they had a match with the Heavenly Bodies on pay-per-view, which was pretty good.
What was the one they did at WrestleMania 9?
That was Head Shrinkers.
That was the Head Shrinkers? Okay.
Yeah. They feud with Money Incorporated. They had a really good cage match with them right before SummerSlam, I think. And they also feud with the Quebecers into 94. And they were gone within a year and a half, for sure. I don't know exactly when they left, but it was, they were gone into 94.
Well, I remember them being back on Nitro before the NWO happened.
Yeah, that was early 96. Yeah. So they did ECW. They probably did a lot of Japan, I'm sure, during that time.
Yeah. Well, and then they then they got chainmail headgear.
Yes.
And have you noticed how Scott Steiner now looks a lot like what you would imagine Rick Steiner to look like at his age?
Okay.
It's like he kind of aged into his brother, because he has the goatee now, and he has the his body type is, I don't know. It just, I get him confused a lot because of the fact that Scott Steiner now looks in my mind like what I think Rick Steiner should look like now. Mm-hmm. If I don't know if that made any sense, but also should his headgear have been illegal?
Why would it have been illegal?
Well, I've never. But if you knew me, you probably instantly realize I've never been an amateur wrestler. But aren't those hard plastic? Or are they just a kind of a?
I don't know. I mean, they're louder in amateur wrestling, so I suppose they'd be fine in professional wrestling.
Yeah, but nobody's headbutting in amateur wrestling. No. If those are hard plastic, you could slam them into the side of some guy's head. That's what I would do. But hey. I don't know.
I don't have good answers. I think we should talk about Steinerized.
Oh, can we talk about the lyrics to the Steiners theme song?
We certainly can. I believe we must, actually.
It's the dumbest thing in the world.
Yeah.
It's okay. It starts out. The singer, and this is the same vocalist, and I wish I knew who it was, because it's the same vocalist that does a lot of the WCW themes.
Right.
We
should mention first that this was not actually their theme during this time. This was their theme when they came back in 96.
What was their theme during this time? Because, see, the YouTube clip that I watched, I think the YouTube clip that I watched had different music on it.
Okay. You know, now I think I'm not sure. Mine didn't show the intros, so I'm almost certain that they were not using that music yet. I feel like that style of music was coming in 93 into 94, where they were doing those type of themes. So that kind of coincided with Jimmy Hart coming in. So I feel like it's unlikely that they had this song at that point. I could be wrong, but
see, I was watching the WWE Classics version that someone had posted on YouTube.
Possible that they just inserted it in, yeah.
Yeah, but the lyrics to Steinerized, mm-hmm. and the vocalist here is the same vocalist that does the American Males, the greatest wrestling theme song in the history of mankind. But it's the same vocalist, and he starts out, here's the story of two brothers, Rick and Scott. So already you know it's good, mm-hmm. because the great theme songs start with the admission up front that you're about to hear a story. Beverly right. Hillbillies, Brady Bunch, they all say, this is a story.
Yes.
They don't use drugs, and they're always on top. And then it gets garbled. Something about their ability, and then the word ability is rhymed with bow on your knees, I believe. And then the chorus is, they take on all comers no matter what size. There won't be any question when you get, and then Steinerized four times.
Yeah.
Then they talk about the Steiners in high school. I wrote all these down. In high school, it was easy to see. I don't know what was easy to see. Next stop, Michigan University.
Which is actually not the name of the, you know.
No, but right. Poetic license.
Sure.
Something, and this is garbled. I couldn't. It's something wrestling All-American. Liked it so much, they went back and did it again. Now, there's a couple of things to examine here. The word American rhymes with did it again.
And okay.
What did they like so much that they – did they go to college twice?
Maybe because they went into professional ranks. They liked wrestling so much they decided to go back and
– But that's not going back. That's going up.
No.
The step from amateur to professional Anyway, the first time the Steinerized chorus, they say it four times. The second time you get a double shot of the chorus.
Yeah.
So you get the word Steinerized eight times. And I'm in my transcription of the lyrics that I wrote by hand, I wrote a little side note here that says, did they ever play the theme song to this point? Because there's another verse, actually two other verses. And I don't know if – I mean the version of – Steinerized on the WCW, I think it's called WCW Slam Jam,
mm-hmm.
Is almost 4 minutes long.
Wow.
And so, I mean, was there ever a situation where they got the entirety of Steinerized out before these guys were in the ring? I don't know the answer to that question.
I don't know the answer to that either. WCW Slam Jam came out in 92, so it's very, very possible that this theme was actually on there, so it was actually part of the show. So,
I mean,
there's no Wikipedia entry for WCW. Well, maybe there is. I'm just not finding it.
There's no Wikipedia entry for just for Steinerized.
There's WCW, ECW, CDs. Well, there's no one for Steinerized that I'm aware of, but...
Oh, see, that's a problem.
Wikipedia is not really being very helpful here.
It's... Guys, you gotta... This is the best song in the world. Anyway, I won't... But there's... Later in the... They talk about Michigan, and they name their moves. Steiner, yeah. Locked, and DDT.
It's the last song on Slam Jam 1. Okay. The songs on Slam Jam 1 from 1992, produced and arranged by Jimmy Papa, by the way. Don't Step to Ron.
Right.
Man Called Sting.
Ugh.
Mr. Bang Bang.
Ugh.
Master of the DDT. Freebird Forever, which is 7 minutes and 5 seconds.
Wow.
Simply Ravishing. Johnny Be Bad. The okay. Natural. The Dragon.
Yeah, well.
He's Smokin'. And Steinerized.
So they closed with Steinerized.
Yeah. They closed with their classics, you know.
Well, you gotta put their strengths at the end.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's not a good song. I mean, it's a great song, but it's not a good song.
Are you gonna have to pay royalties because I played that? Could you hear that? I was playing it.
I could hear it. Yes. I feel like probably that they're. I don't think I'm big enough where they're gonna really go after me.
I don't want you to have to pay for the rights to Steinerized. Although if they're cheap enough. Maybe we could go in together and just buy it outright, and then we could use it anytime we wanted.
I'll keep that in mind as a marketing strategy.
I'm just saying. Look, yeah. I'm just spitballing ideas here.
Hey, I appreciate that.
I don't know. You know, I don't know what your marketing and clearances budget is, but you may want to consider buying Steinerized.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that more off.
I've got a business plan drawn up here for you.
Yeah, we don't want anybody to steal our idea after all.
No.
All right, man. Well, anything else that you can think of to bring up regarding this subject?
No, I think we've pretty well covered it. Maybe I like the Steiners a little better after watching this. I mean, it wasn't terrible. I just... For some reason, those guys never worked for me. But I think this may have been the beginning of a reversal of opinion on these guys.
All right. Well, you'll have to let me know how that goes for you if you explore any more Steiners and if they do find, this was sort of toward the end of them being kind of mind-blowingly great. I mean, they had their good moments after this, but it was, you know, never quite the same, you know. As it was in, 1991.
Well, the lack of him in this match made me, as soon as I was done watching this one, I just typed Terry Gordy into YouTube, and there's not much. There is a really bad fan-made video of clips of Terry Gordy set to the song Freebird,
mm-hmm.
but the clips are all murky. And hard to see what's going on. But
have you seen Terry Gordy and Killer Khan Texas Deathmatch?
No, I've not.
You should. 1984 from World Class. I posted them on my Friends of Retrospective Facebook page.
I will check that out.
All right.
I will definitely check that out.
I highly recommend it. It's very good.
Guys, get into Terry Gordy. That's all I get. If there's one message, if there's one takeaway, to use a business term,
from this. We should answer a question from that we had from a mass tweeter.
Oh, yeah.
Gordy, a better partner for Dr. Death than DiBiase and Rotundo?
I mean...
I haven't Gordy. Seen any DiBiase in Williams, so that one I'm not sure about. I've heard that team was fine, but nothing particularly special.
Gordy, to me, is always going to be a free bird. And so It's hard for me to watch him with anybody else. But at this point in my life as a wrestling fan, I am so pro Terry Gordy that I will say Terry Gordy is a better tag team partner for anyone than anybody else.
I couldn't have said better than myself.
I will change that opinion in probably 6 months. So, but as of October the, what are we on? 11th? As of October the 11th, 2012.
10, 11, Terry 12.
Terry Gordy is a better tag team partner for anyone than anyone else.
Very good. So, let everyone know where they can find your wonderful products and anything else you would like to mention that you're up to.
I'm working on the fourth issue. It's going to have a report about the two Chikara shows that I went to. I've already started writing it. I'm about three pages deep, and I haven't mentioned wrestling yet. There's a little bit in there about the late 70s relaxation of the federal length requirements for tractor trailers. There's a little bit in there about Smokey and the Bandit, a little bit in there about the band High Spirits, and a weird tangent about the Carolina Panthers. I think that eventually I will start to write about wrestling in this wrestling fanzine that I'm writing, but we'll have to see. So you'll have to check out the fourth issue when that comes out. It should be out by the end of the year at the latest. I'm hoping to get it out sometime in November. Something's going to happen. I got to beat this thing into shape to make it readable. But the rest of my stuff is in print. You can go to The Atomic Elbow. Please don't forget the article. TheAtomicElbow.blogspot.com, because I'm too cheap to pay for a website. And you can see a link to my online store. You can see all of the issues, all the dumb stuff that I've done is going to be up there. Also, I put pictures of wrestlers on the internet at professionalwrestling.tumblr.com. I'm on the Twitter machine at atomic_elbow. And then I have a personal Twitter account at secondperiod. That's all one word, no underscore. And then that podcast where I play records at you and then talk about the records I played. It's basically just a one-hour-long radio show, but nobody will let me on the radio anymore because radio's dying. So I decided to do it myself. It's not on iTunes because I don't know how to put a podcast on iTunes.
Well, I can show you that.
And I also don't know if I can put this one on iTunes because it's mostly just me playing records.
Yeah, that might be an issue.
So it's not on iTunes, but maybe one day it will be if people show me how and I figure out if it's legal or not. But that's most of the stuff I do. I do some other stuff, but
all right.
If you're in Athens, give me a call. We'll hang out.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you for asking me to be on the show. This is always fun for me, and I always feel weird because I've listened to other episodes of yours, and you guys are straight down the middle just tearing it up with the wrestling talk. And for a guy who has a wrestling fanzine and website and everything, I just don't know much about wrestling other than the fact that I like it. So yeah, I always feel like I'm stinking up the joint when I'm around here, but you keep asking me to come back, so I'm going to keep doing it.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate that. I think you do a great job. And thanks, everyone, for checking us out, of course. You can find us at WrestleSpective.com. We're on Twitter and Facebook. Also, please do not forget to check out our sponsors, RudoReels.com and InternationalObject.com. So we'll be back again with more podcast goodness. Thanks for listening.